Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin. On today's show, we have with us Dr. David Berlinski, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, who received his PhD in philosophy from Princeton University and was later a postdoctoral fellow in mathematics and molecular biology at Columbia University. He's written books on a number of different topics, including math, science, and philosophy, and his latest book, The Deniable Darwin, is a compendium of essays written by Dr. Berlinski on topics related to origins, materialism, and evolution. We're very fortunate to have Dr. Berlinski on the show with us today. Let's talk about your new book, The Deniable Darwin, which is available, by the way, at deniabledarwin.com or davidberlinski.org. This book is obviously a compendium of essays that you've written over your entire career, and many of these have been very popular essays that you've written in a variety of different sources. So what exactly are some of the topics that these essays cover?
These essays really represent one whole part of my literary life. They date back to 1993, 1994. And I have written things before that. In the 1970s, I was doing a lot of technical stuff. In the 1980s, I was doing a bit, but it didn't make it into the volume. These essays are really unified by what I would like to think is my newfound identity, dating to 1994, 1995, as a scientific critic, somebody who does very much what a restaurant critic would do, or an art critic, or a book critic, looks at various scientific theories and tries to form an intelligible critical opinion about what's going on. The most notorious essay is The Deniable Darwin, which I published in Commentary in 1996, and I think next to Phil Johnson's Darwin on Trial, it represents one of the first direct attacks on Darwinian theory. And that attracted a tremendous amount of attention. But a lot of the other things I did for Commentary attracted a lot of attention, too. I did a piece on the Big Bang cosmology and evolutionary psychology, and some speculative pieces as well. I like to think there's a unified point of view, that is unified around the idea that there is a reasonable role for skepticism throughout the sciences, not just Darwin's theory of evolution, but throughout the sciences. But I leave that to others to judge how successfully I've maintained that point of view. Don't forget, I knock intelligent design too. I don't want anyone to forget that.
Absolutely. No, that is correct. And one of the things I enjoyed about the book is how it organizes many of your essays chronologically, so we can kind of trace, you know, your thinking, and even some of them cover current events at the time that they were written. For example, yeah, a memoriam of Stephen Jay Gould, which is fascinating.
I'm very grateful to the Discovery Institute, and especially to David Klinghoffer, my editor, for allowing me to see. Believe me, it comes as something of a surprise to me as well to see the chronological development of these ideas. I had really dreaded the thought that all that work, and I put tons of work into these things, would just disappear. And that's the fate of most essays. A few of them have been collected in the best science collections, things like that. But I really just dreaded the idea that even for me, for my own personal use, there would be no one place I could turn to ask myself, what was I thinking? How did I develop these ideas? And I would love to think that someone else will find that interesting. You never know. No writer ever really knows. But it is a tremendous privilege to have that collection at hand. I'm really grateful for that.
Well, I think this is a very valuable collection. And the essays cover three basic topics. I'd like to start with the first one, sort of chronologically, perhaps in the history of the universe, not necessarily in the book, but that is the origin of matter. Now, I recall a couple years ago that actually in an interview, Richard Dawkins admitted that he doesn't have an explanation for the origin of matter. So where exactly is the scientific community in its quest to explain the origin of matter?
Oh, Casey, nobody really knows. Nobody knows anything much about the origins of matter, because so much of this stuff is at the outer limits of grope and fumble. You got to remember that the origins of matter is really a question about the origins of the universe, because according to Einstein, matter and energy are really the same thing. So it doesn't make any difference whether you're talking about the origins of matter or the origins of energy in the universe. They come to the same thing. So these questions very quickly become fundamental metaphysical questions. How did everything begin? To a certain extent, but just to a certain extent, we are sort of maneuvering ourselves so that we begin to see how a possible answer would take shape. You've got this huge superconducting super collider out in Lausanne, the CERN outfit. And one of the things they're trying to find out is if there is evidence for the existence of the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson is a purely hypothetical particle. No one's ever seen it. But if they can detect the Higgs boson, then particle physicists think they will have a, call it a window of opportunity, to explain to themselves the origins of mass. That's not quite the same thing as the origins of matter, but the origins of mass remain an outstanding problem with respect to the standard model of particle physics. So in a curious way, there is a kind of snake-like movement. But the ultimate question that you're asking, that remains hopelessly, hopelessly unresolved. And I don't think from within the community of particle physicists there is any expectation that no matter how long you allow the sciences to progress, we'll really have a complete explanation for the origin of things in general. That's asking a lot. It's asking a whole lot.
Well, the next question, probably chronologically in the history of the universe, is the origin of the diversity of living creatures. Now, surely Darwinian evolution has settled this question for us all, has it not?
Well, no, it hasn't. There are two questions. The origins of life, which really remain very enigmatic. And in 2009, approaching 2010, I think there's a really significant sense among origins of life researchers that although there's been a tremendous amount learned, that shouldn't for a moment be forgotten, a tremendous amount has been learned. The RNA world hypotheses leave so many questions unexplained. And various chemical scenarios, for example, Harold Marowitz, a very smart chemist, biochemist, who had a background in physics, the various chemical scenarios by which the emergence of life is treated strictly as a chemical and biochemical or inorganic chemical problem, there are too many gaps in that scenario to feel any confidence that in the long run people will be able to explain the significant aspects of this question. So there's a kind of weariness to the whole field, even though the press releases are quite the contrary. They're all bubbling and full of optimism. But you go to the literature itself, and you see quite a different reaction. You see very much the same problems occurring again and again and again. And these problems are no closer to resolution than they were 20 years ago. You know, there was a tremendous period of optimism 20 years ago when the RNA world hypothesis was first introduced. But gradually that's dissipated. We still really don't understand how these curious systems at the beginning of biological time could have assembled spontaneously. Don't forget when I talk about the beginning of biological time, this was before natural selection played a role. Because we can't assume that at the beginning there were replicators. That is, of course, impossible as an assumption. And the chemistry doesn't seem to point us in quite the right direction. Self-organizing systems don't seem to be particularly helpful. So there is a sense of discouragement in origins of life research. I don't know whether the sense is a profound sense, but it's certainly there. People are again and again and again coming to the conclusion that these problems are deep, they're intractable, and over the course of, say, 50 years, they haven't yielded to any kind of simple strategy. And that's very puzzling. That's very puzzling because one would have thought on the basis of molecular biology and on the basis of various naturalistic assumptions in which the emergence of life is traced back to inorganic chemistry, one would have thought if that were really as feasible a plan or a scheme as one imagined, we should have been able to figure out how it worked, but we haven't. And that's a very suggestive piece of evidence. I think in the history of the sciences, what one cannot do is often as important as what one can do.
One of my personal favorite parts of your writing, Dr. Berlinski, is when you discuss the evolution of the eye. And I know that this is an oft-discussed matter cited by evolutionists that you cover in your book. Do you feel that evolutionists have solved the problem how the eye evolved?
I think it's exactly in the same condition as it was when Darwin wrote in 1859. By no means must we limit ourselves to the eye. The ear is a similarly opaque organ. In fact, all the modalities of the senses are very difficult to understand. In the case of the eye, which is exquisite and powerful, and it is obviously, not only our avenue of access to the external world, but our avenue of access to one another, the eyes of the mirror of the soul. Darwin's solution to the problem, he admitted the problem was vexing. His solution to the problem, or his indicated solution, was to consider all the intermediates in the animal kingdom, different kinds of eyes. And he was certainly right about that. But the conclusion that he drew, that because we could see intermediates, we could also see a single, directed, stable, oriented path leading to the formation of a complex eye, that just doesn't follow, and we still haven't been able to see how that could have taken place over the course of any reasonable amount of time. If you give yourself an infinite amount of time, you can do anything. No, the emergence of the eye, the emergence of these equally modulated organs of sense, instruments of a high degree of complexity, that's pretty baffling. It's pretty baffling. We don't really have a clue. And every time an evolutionary biologist, I have solved the problem. You know, in my book, I discuss Nielsen and Peldra, who are two Swedish biologists. They're very distinguished. Dan Nielsen was an extremely, and still is, an extremely credible scientist. And they published a paper saying, there's nothing to it, nothing to it. We can get an eye in what amounts to the blink of an eye. And when you look closely at the paper, it is all assumption and no consequences. It simply assumes the problem away.
Now, the third mystery that your book explores, Dr. Berlinski, is obviously the origin and existence of the human mind. Do you think that science will find a materialist explanation for this? And also, I'd like to ask you, what piqued your personal interest in the question of where the human mind comes from?
Well, I think the question is a very interesting question on its own. You don't have to have a particular bias. You don't have to be involved in any disputes about Darwin's theory of evolution to make that question interesting. After all, we come into the world with these remarkable mental powers and properties for which we have no explanation, and we can only treat them as a gift in some sense. We're not only able to form an avenue of access to the external world, but we can convey our thoughts, we can use a language, we can do mathematics, we can do all sorts of mental calculations, we have a will, we are agents, we have emotion, sentiment. It is very rich when we think about our own minds. And, of course, there are tremendous philosophical problems involved. We don't understand what agency really is. We don't have a good account of free will. We're not even certain that we have free will, although very often it is said that the existence of free will is somehow in contravention of the methods of the sciences. It's not deterministic. But if we deny the existence of the free will and say something to the effect that everything that you do, for example, scratching your forehead now, is somehow or was somehow part of the original apparatus of the universe, so that Casey Luskin scratching his forehead in Seattle was written into the Big Bang, that's very strange too. The idea that everything that we do is deterministic is as ill-fitting with the body of science as its denial. So that we're in the position of saying, no matter which way we turn, we cannot seem easily, in terms of the various scientific paradigms, to encompass what we are and how we go about doing what we do. And I think this is very mysterious. I don't know of anything that would suggest what an answer would look like. Clearly, certain kinds of answers are childishly unacceptable, to say that the human mind and everything about a human personality, the human soul, can be reduced to the interaction of chemicals in the brain. Nobody's satisfied with that. Even people who say they're satisfied with it know better in their heart of hearts. That kind of position is being articulated because it's necessary for the party line. But beyond that, everything is very mysterious, and it doesn't hurt to say so. It doesn't hurt to say so. I don't think any party to contemporary discussion has a good idea where to go. Nor is it clear that there is a place to go. You know, all of us very often think about what we're doing in the progress of the scientific establishment, enlarging the scope of theories as if there were a body of theory out there. Only we could reach it. There's a wonderful line from Auden, "Far impossible, the head lifts the mountain's lovely head, whose white waterfall could bless travelers in their last distress." And we all kind of think that way. It's out there if we only could reach it. But that may be false. There may be nothing out there. There's an equivalently moving story by Paul Bowles, the exiled writer who lived in Tangiers for so long. It's called The Sheltering Sky. Have you seen the movie or read the short story?
No, I'm not familiar.
Very few people have. The protagonists are in the desert. The desert is immensely isolated. There's huge, huge canopy above them. And one asks the other, what's on the other side? What's beyond? And the answer is, it's a haunting answer, nothing. It's just nothing there. That may be true of the scientific imagination, too, when we talk about resolving these problems about who we are, what our nature is. There just may be nothing there. I don't know.
Dr. Brilinski, I'd like to close up our interview with a couple last questions here. One, what is your favorite essay that you published in The Deniable Darwin that you've written?
Ooh, I think the essay that comes closest to achieving what I really wanted to achieve, one was to make a fuss and cause a commotion. Two was set out certain conclusions. And three, find a rhetorical way to express what I needed to express is the title essay itself. I never got as good as that ever in my life. And I wrote it very quickly over the course of 2 or 3 days. And I thought I would just go on writing in that style and having that, what I thought was, a rhetorically effective strategy, and everything else after that became insanely difficult. I don't mind admitting, just insanely difficult. No, I think the essay that's closest to my heart is The Deniable Darwin. No question about that.
Well, and I think it's no coincidence, Dr. Brilinski, that that is one of the most popular essays that you've written. And we get requests for that essay quite a bit here at Discovery Institute.
I should say, Casey, it happens once in a lifetime that you can pull it off. I'm very grateful. I certainly don't feel I pulled it off. I'm just very grateful it happened.
Well, the last question I'd like to ask you is, in the end, you know, when all is said and done, which book do you think will be the most significant? The Greatest Show on Earth, Origin of Species, or The Deniable Darwin?
Well, I think Origin of Species will continue to live forever. I think there's not. It's just like the Principia. No matter what judgment one makes about Darwin's theory of evolution, and you know my judgment is essentially negative, the historical importance has been established. There's no point in denying it. I very often make a sophomoric fun of Darwin because he is plodding. I don't find him personally an attractive figure in any way. I think there's a great deal of dissembling and dishonesty in the Origin of Species, a reluctance to face what he himself is doing directly. But that it is and has changed the way we think, I think, is undeniable. The Greatest Show on Earth will be forgotten in 5 years, but I'm very much afraid the same thing is true of anything I've written. It's destined to achieve its appropriate fate, which is oblivion. But look, so what? So what? You do the best you can anyway. It's no argument against not working, not writing, that it's not going to live. But Richard Dawkins, I think some of his work will live. It will be continued to be read. Not the way Darwin is, but he will be remembered as a very significant figure in late 20th century thought. Of that, I have no doubt. He has made himself something really remarkable. I don't find it entirely praiseworthy, but not entirely negligible either. You know, everybody on Earth keeps talking about Richard Dawkins. That says something. That is a tribute to the man. I can't deny it.
Dr. Brilinski, if the number of inquiries that we get about your work is any indication, I think that your work, too, is going to continue to have a following into the future. But we very much appreciate your time.
I hope so.
Well, we hope so, too. If you're interested in Dr. Brilinski's book, the website is deniabledarwin.com or davidbrilinski.org. That's deniabledarwin.com or davidbrilinski.org. His new book is The Deniable Darwin, published by Discovery Institute Press. And Dr. Brilinski, you're actually doing quite a bit of speaking about the book right now, I understand.
I'm speaking my head off. I'm yakking and babbling at every opportunity. Every writer does it, and anybody who goes on a lecture tour has the same reaction. On the one hand, it's exhilarating. On the other hand, it is so dreary to do the same thing again. And I actually think I could hardwire my tongue to my spleen and talk without the intervention of any higher cerebral categories. Because you say the same thing. You have to. You can't make up something new each time. It's just not possible.
Well, we wish you the best in all that you're doing right now, Dr. Brilinski, and thank you for coming on the show with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care, Casey.
Well, thank you, and this is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Once again, go check out the book, The Deniable Darwin, at deniabledarwin.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.